If you're ever lucky enough to go to Ireland, I have two recommendations for you. First of all, use my wife as your travel advisor. My wife, Priscilla, is technically a law professor, but really she missed her calling. She's one of those people who can save up hotel points and get travel discounts to the point that she was able to send me to Ireland last summer and to put me up in what is arguably the very best hotel in the entire country. It's called the Shelburne. It's a 5-star hotel. It's right on St. Vincent's Green in Dublin. It was an incredible experience. And my recommendation when you get there is that you speak to the concierge, Dennis O'Brien, who will tell you all about the drafting of the Irish Constitution. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the birth of the Republic of Ireland.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches at the Appalachian School of Law.
If you've ever had the privilege of staying in a really fine hotel, as I did recently, you know that the concierge is a key guy, the go-to guy in any such establishment, who can tell you where to go for dinner, can get you tickets to the latest show, can tell you all about the back streets and byways in his vicinity, because that's his or her job, is to get you where you're going and to help you along your way. Wouldn't you like to have one of those guys in your daily life? I'm sorry, I stray. Recently, I had the pleasure of meeting perhaps the uber concierge of them all, the king of the concierges. His name was Dennis O'Brien. He worked at a place called the Shelburne Hotel, which is a perfectly wonderful place in the city of Dublin in the Republic of Ireland. And Dennis not only knew all the usual concierge things, Dennis knew something about his own hotel and about his own country's history that's remarkably special. You see, the Shelburne Hotel was where the Irish Constitution was drafted. Is that remarkable or what? They've actually got a special room that they've set aside. They call it the Constitution Room. And this was the room where people sat down and pounded out the compromises that eventually made their way largely into the Constitution of Ireland as it was later adopted. Now, in order to understand everything that went on at the Shelburne Hotel, Dennis had to back up a little bit. He had to go back all the way to about 1916, when Britain and Ireland were engaged in a very important struggle for the independence of the Republic. Oh, by the way, before we begin with Dennis, I want to emphasize, I'm not taking sides. I realize that these events were rather recent in the historical memory and that there are still some fairly strong feelings on both sides of the Irish independence issue in Northern Ireland and Britain and all the rest of that. I'm not taking sides. I'm simply giving Dennis a chance to tell his story and the story of the Shelburne Hotel from his perspective. Now, here's Dennis.
Well, before we talk about probably the premier event, which was the drafting of the Irish Constitution of 1922, we need to go back a couple of years, 6 years really to be exact, to understand the significance of the event 6 years later.
Okay.
You know, I think when you look at it, you see that, you know, we had been under the control of the British, and I suppose people had decided at a time enough was enough. And that we're going to rise up against the British. I don't, politically, this was all to happen on the 23rd of April 1916, which was Easter Sunday. But as you would say in modern day parlance, people didn't get their act together. They didn't mobilise in time. And General O'Neill decided it's not going to happen today. We'll do it tomorrow, which was the 24th of April 1916, which happened to be Easter Monday. So here in Ireland, it will be known as the Easter Rising of 1916. And that's those who would be more educational or academic might say the insurrection against the British in 1916. Mm-hmm. But ask anybody in the street of a particular generation, and they'll say to you, oh, the 1916 Rising. And as you know, this is 2014, so in 2 years' time, we will celebrate the centenary of this great event. Anyway, the hotel here...
Now, forgive my ignorance and the ignorance, perhaps, of some people who are listening, but that is that's sort of like our Independence Day in the United States, yeah. Right?
That's your 1776.
Right, our July 4th, yeah. And so that's going to be yours.
You know, 1976, when you had your bicentenary.
Right.
Look at all the celebration that was. Well, we're a much younger nation that way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you can imagine what's going. Yes, you can imagine what's going to happen in 2016.
Well, I'll have to come back in 2 years then. Absolutely. That'll be my excuse.
You know, the good thing about Ireland is a bit like a boomerang effect. Once you come here, that effect has come on to come back again. So yeah, 1916 is going to be very special. You know, and it really doesn't matter about your political, which side of the political fence you sit on. It's going to be for the whole country to celebrate in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 1916, you can imagine what it's like. The ladies are sitting in the lounge, very genteelly having their afternoon tea, with tea, coffee, scones, clotted cream, pastries, maybe a little glass of champagne just to wash it all down or to aid digestion. And literally all hell breaks loose across the street.
Was that where it happened, right?
That's
in St. Stephen's Green?
One of the locations. See, when you look at Irish history and 1916, you will hear people mention the General Post Office, the GPO on Collins Street. You'll hear people saying Dublin Castle. You'll hear people mention Boland's Mills. But the lesser known fact is that the role of St. Stephen's Green, which is just across from us, played in the whole events over those few days.
Okay.
You know, the British lived here. The British establishment, the British aristocracy, the military establishment, they all lived here. So if you look at our registration book, which is on display in the Museum of 1916, you'll see General and Lady Lowry, Colonel and Mrs., Captain, Major, all, and nearly all, to a man or woman, have all got British and Northern Ireland addresses.
Oh, so this is where the British lived.
This is where the British lived.
Where they stayed. When they came to Dublin. So I imagine that the revolutionaries didn't particularly like this place. This is a hotbed of all of the people they were rebelling against.
Absolutely. And I suppose you would, again, using modern-day parlance, would see it as a legitimate target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the heart of the British establishment. So if something was to happen here, it would be of major political, social and military significance. So the British were no idiots, no fools. They knew that if this old lady fell into the hands of the insurgents, the rebels, that would be a completely different outlook and maybe result of what was going on over the next few days. At any time, it wasn't just that they hadn't got a clue what was going to happen. So you can imagine the ladies sitting there enjoying afternoon tea, gentlemen sipping their gin and tonics. They wouldn't have drank too much Guinness because that wouldn't have been a type of tipple for them.
Right.
So what happened was some fighting went on outside. And the interesting fact was, you know, militarily, the insurgents far outnumbered the British here. The British had soldiers here guarding the place constantly. So there was a military presence here protecting those who lived here. At least 100 troops decided to dig in across in St. Stephen's Green. So they didn't attack the building. If they had done that, they would have easily taken over the building. They didn't. Why did they do that? We don't know. Militarily, the experts will tell you there was no logistical reason as to why they dig in. But they did. And just something which may interest your listeners is, you know, the insurgents were led by an Irishman who was an officer in the British Army, but who left the British Army and joined the Irish Citizen Army, and his name was Commandant Michael Mallon. Now, again, you know, the ladies will tell us that behind every good man is a better woman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his second in command is a lady of tremendous importance and significance, and her name was Constance Countess Markievicz.
Really? And she was second in command?
She was second in command.
Well, that's one for the ladies. Did you notice that, ladies? Yes, there she is.
And when you look at it, in many ways, you know, ahead of probably a lot of modern armies who wouldn't have had the roles of females for many, many years later. You ask about Constance Markievicz, and the older generation will tell you, you know, she was an Irish woman from County Sligo called Gorbooth. She married a Polish count, and thus she got her title. Countess Markievicz. Traditionally here in Ireland, we name a lot of our important buildings, including things like train stations, after people who have played a significant role in the history of our state. So I know you have Penn Station in New York and you have others. In Dublin, we would have Connolly Station, after James Connolly, one of the leaders of 1916. Michael Mallon, one of the commanding officers of 1916. Eamon Kent, one of the signatories of 19... McDiarmid and McDermott. So we remember them to this very day in buildings. Official government buildings will be named. Sometimes it might be called Oris McDiarmid, which is the house of McDermott, which is one of the signatories, or Thomas Clark House, remembering them. But getting back to the time here of 1916, Michael Mallon and Constance Countess Markievicz had about 100 soldiers across the road. They dug in. They let rip, as we would say. They had started firing across, much to the annoyance of the ladies who were having afternoon tea in the lounge. The British barricaded the buildings, the windows, with the furniture from within. The ladies took their afternoon tea and their sandwiches, scones and clotted cream, and relocated themselves behind the lounge into more secure and less noisy location.
Well, I'm glad they didn't have to interrupt their tea for too long.
Oh, heaven forbid they'd have to do that, you know. Heaven forbid. There was a tradition there that was not going to be broken by anybody. We still have the tradition of having afternoon tea, but it's less, what would you say, stuffy.
Right. I've noticed that about Ireland generally. It's not a stuffy country. It's anything but. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've yet to meet anybody who's less than very, very friendly here and very, very down to earth.
You know, there's a lot of things in life that are in our nature, and you can't change that. And I think here in Ireland, it's in our nature to be polite, to be helpful, I suppose to have a sense of humour, which is right. And I think I also think the fact that we never conquered the world. We never invaded anybody's space. You know, we were never in, again, to use modern day parlance, in somebody's face. You know, we didn't decide that we'd send our boats, now mind you, we wouldn't have had too many of them, and decide to pillage islands off our coast. We didn't do that.
That'd be a great tourist slogan. Ireland, visit Ireland, we never got in anybody's face.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting. Yeah, it might be one of those phrases that you could coin. But you know, I think it's in the nature of our beast. I would like to think that as a nation we're very diplomatic. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that we support the underdog, and that we'll always give somebody the benefit of the doubt. I think you've got to do that. Mm-hmm. But getting back to this old lady.
So they barricaded themselves and they didn't interrupt their tea for long.
The ladies had their tea in the room, which is now their famous horseshoe bar. And then what happened was staff couldn't get to work. So you can imagine then, the next day, which was Tuesday, the ladies had to empty their own chamber pots.
Oh, good heavens.
Heaven forbid. That was the ultimate sacrilege. And then to add injury to insult to injury, the gentlemen had to slice their own lemons for the gin and tonics.
Good heavens.
So they were not amused.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dennis O'Brien of the Shelburne Hotel in Dublin, Ireland, all about the drafting of the Irish Constitution, which, believe it or not, took place right there at the Shelburne. After the break, we'll come back and we'll speak some more with Dennis, so stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dennis O'Brien, the concierge of the historic Shelburne Hotel in Dublin, Ireland, where some pretty important events occurred, both in the independence movement in the Republic of Ireland and in the subsequent drafting of the constitution of that country. Before the break, Dennis was telling us about the uprising and about the role that the Shelburne played in it.
The fighting continued. So you can imagine Monday, the ladies and gents are guests of the hotel. And on Tuesday, no disrespect, the lunatics take over the asylum. Mm-hmm. And they have to look after themselves. You've got to remember, if something happens in the world in 2014 at noon, the rest of the world knows about it at 1 minute past noon. In 1916, those are very different times. There was no communication of any great worth. So people didn't know what was going on. And then you had the British putting up roadblocks to stop the insurgents going around the city, and the insurgents putting up barricades to disrupt the city as much as it could. So by Tuesday, the next day, staff couldn't get to work. So about a handful of staff were here, were certainly outnumbered by the guests, and the guests now had to look after themselves. On Wednesday the 26th, a truce was organised, and at a time when we're talking about conflict around the world, you know, truce is an important thing, mm-hmm. organised by the Irish Red Cross, that injured people, the injured parties on both sides are now treated by the same people who were having afternoon tea on Monday, making their own beds on Tuesday, are now tending to the sick and injured on Wednesday. So the hotel goes from being a hotel to now being a field hospital for injuries on both sides. And then history will tell you with our nation, we then decided, the Irish people at the time decided, look, let's negotiate with Great Britain. Let's have a treaty. And the treaty was signed on behalf of the provisional government by Michael Collins with the Israeli's government in Great Britain. And history will tell us that, you know, Michael Collins was sent to negotiate on behalf of the Irish delegation. And as you know, in Ireland, the United States is made up of 50 states. In Ireland, the island of Ireland is made up of 32 counties, which is then broken into four provinces. The province of Leinster, which covers the eastern seaboard, the province of Munster, which is the south, the province of Connacht, which is the northwest and west, and the province of Ulster, which is basically north and northwest. And in
northeast?
Northeast to northwest, okay. Yes. It kind of spends, goes from Donegal across to Antrim, down to Cavan and Monaghan. Mm-hmm. Now, there are nine counties in that province. And Michael Collins was sent to Great Britain. Some will tell you, depending on your political leanings, with a poison chalice to get back the nine counties. He came back with three out of the nine, which horrified a lot. And others would have said, he did his best. Anyway, the treaty was signed with Great Britain that we would take back three and they would keep six. So the province of Ulster has nine counties, but Northern Ireland only has six of those nine counties.
I see. And so when we talk about Irish independence, we're talking about the Republic of Ireland, which includes the entire island except for those few counties.
From six counties in Northern Ireland.
Right.
From the province of Ulster, there are three of those in the Republic of Ireland, which is Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal, which form part of Ulster, but those three remain in Northern Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland.
Okay, so when was the Republic of Ireland actually declared then?
Not until the early 40s.
So 1940s?
That we became as we are now today. So it's a very different...
So basically you had the revolt in 1916, but 1916, it took another 20 or 30 years to...
Absolutely, until you got recognised, as the Republic of Ireland. Because we went through the state then of being, you know, Ireland. And then 1916, we had the insurrection against the British. And then for the next couple of years, we had the treaty. And then, like most countries, when people decide, we've had enough of governing you, we leave you to your own desire, the Civil War broke out. Mm-hmm. So that then made situation of Irish brother against brother, cousin against cousin. Politically, in our chamber, in the lower house of our parliament, you'd still have people who were pro-treaty and anti-treaty. you would have people in various villages around Ireland who you wouldn't know the political persuasion from them until they were buried. So you knew which undertaker or which type of service that they had.
Oh boy.
But you know, yeah. You know, small little villages where you'd have three undertakers. One you'd know is that side of the house, to this other side, and then there's a neutral man. And you could tell, oh, yeah, he'd always supported the treaty people, or he was an anti-treaty man. So then what happened, when we had a civil war, we had brother fighting brother. The loss of life was tremendous. And the provisional government at the time said, you know, well, we've broken away from the British, the ceasefire, we have a cessation of violence in our civil war, but we need to pull a rule book in place as to how this little country of ours is going to be governed in the future. You know, I suppose you have a Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. In Ireland, they decided, let's put a constitution into place. They've got to remember that all of the laws that were in place were all inherited from the time of the British.
Right.
So you had 1861, you would have acts, we say about larceny, people stealing things, and it would have been 1861. And you would have other acts who were various, 1912. And some of them are still on our statute books because they were relevant. But the provisional government said, you know, we got to put a rule book in place as to how we're going to move forward. Anyway.
So just to get the chronology again, you have the insurrection in 1916.
Yeah.
About 6 years of civil war, and then by about 1922...
Between that, a treaty and a right. civil war, yes.
Treaty, the civil war, and then about 1922... the Irish decide they're going to put together their own constitution. I think Michael Collins plays a pretty big role in that too, doesn't he?
Yeah, Michael Collins. You know, Michael Collins insisted, his own insistence, that he would chair this committee. And it was made up of politicians. I suppose when you look at it, it was made up of politicians, entrepreneurs, civil servants. It had three secretaries who were taking notes. It had one Gaelic scholar, because the intention was at some stage that it would be translated into Gaelic, into the Irish language. So there was one Gaelic scholar. So they met here in the hotel, in room 112. Now, the first meeting in the last few days of January, but regularly between February and May 1922, they met in this very hotel, and they put together a number of drafts of the constitution of what was then the Irish Free State, Saoirse Stáit na hÉireann. The Irish Ireland didn't exist, as you know, as a Republic of Ireland. Mm-hmm. People will say, you know, Éireann go bra and all those things. They were still, when the constitution was drafted in those days, it was the Irish Free State. Collins was the chair of the committee. Another man who was kind of a particular interest is a guy called Darrell Figgis. Darrell Figgis was kind of like the architect. You can imagine a modern day company secretary who sits back and listens to what everybody has to say, or in many ways kind of like a facilitator who will listen to what different arguments of a, and then he will come up with a document like a facilitator, arbitrator. This was Figgis. Figgis's claim was that, you know, he was a Republican and a nationalist, and there's nothing unusual in those days, but Darrell Figgis was a member of the Church of Ireland Faith. He was Protestant. He wasn't a Roman Catholic, because in those days, to be a nationalist Republican meant really that you were a Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. So, as you would say, Darrell Figgis bucked the system. He didn't tick all the boxes. Figgis was a really kind of man about town, very dapper. His image, how he looked to people, was very important. So, nice tweeds and a nice hat. But his prize possession was a ginger beard. That was his prize possession. And here, one night, while answering a knock to the door, a group of men burst in and attacked him and his wife, and then committed the ultimate sacrilege by cutting his beard off.
Oh, how terrible.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine a fate no worse.
Could you imagine? But his comment was, I would have preferred, if they had cut my troth, than to cut my beard.
Cut my troth?
Yeah, than to cut my beard.
Forgive me for my ignorance again, but what did he mean? His wife?
No, that he would have preferred that they'd killed him rather than cut off his beard. His beard was the most important to him.
I wasn't getting that.
No.
I'd rather they slit my throat than cut off my beard. Well, I love my own beard. I don't know if I love it that much. That, okay, they knew what to do to get his goat.
Absolutely, and they did. And then what followed, I think, was very strange. Michael Collins decided to give Figgis a gun, which I found strange because being a nationalist and Republican, I automatically assumed that he would carry a firearm, but he didn't. And as you know, even to this day, firearms in Ireland are very strictly controlled. We don't have a right to bear arms. The only people who have a right to carry guns would be members of the military and certain parts of the police force. Even our police force, to this day, is completely unarmed.
So really? That's
remarkable. I know that would be difficult for some of your listeners to understand.
We've got a lot of guns in the United States. That is almost unimaginable to have a police force that's not armed.
We would have what we call detectives who don't wear uniform, who are armed. There is an emergency response unit who would be armed and uniformed. And they are clearly marked in their cars. So it's a very dear. So in those days, it would have been common to have a gun. But Figgis didn't have one. Michael Collins gave him a gun for his protection. The very next day, while travelling in a taxi, Daryl Figgis's wife committed suicide with the same gun that Michael Collins had given her for the protection.
Good heavens.
So.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, we talk now in modern day parlance about post-traumatic stress syndrome. Those days we wouldn't have known what it was. But certainly the effect of having a group of men burst into her house and invade her space.
Did they attack her specifically?
They both were beaten up pretty badly. Yeah. So she shot herself while travelling out of the city. Daryl Figgis and Collins worked very close. They trusted each other to a certain point. They say, as you know, you keep your friends close and your enemies even closer. Mm-hmm. They did that.
Both. Now you mentioned Figgis was a Protestant.
Yeah.
And that is a huge issue here, or at least it was at that time. And in fact, as I think you said a moment ago, it wasn't typical for a Republican to be a Protestant.
No, you know, a nationalist and a Republican, the third part of the trilogy would have been, or the Trinity, whichever way you want to call it, would be Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. So that's why he said he bucked the system. He was nationalist, Republican, but Church of Ireland, which would be Episcopalian.
Right.
And we would have had other historical characters during the history of the state.
You mentioned one other thing before we go on. You mentioned Gaelic, or as it's commonly called, the Irish language now. That's also an important aspect of Irish nationalism, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we have an old saying, you would call them, what do you call them? What do you call them in English? Like a stitch in time, what do you call them?
Aphorism or saying?
Yeah, but in Ireland we call... In Gaelic, it's translated into old world, Shan Uchel, which means old in word, or old words. Mm-hmm. And in Ireland, they say, Tír gan anam, Tír gan teanga, Tír gan anam. So a country without its tongue or its language is a country that doesn't have a name. We would say, if we don't have our language, we don't have our name. Every document that's produced on behalf of the state or government agencies is obliged to be produced in both English and Irish. Mm-hmm. As a citizen of the country, if you're in a situation of... if you're before the courts, for instance, you're entitled to be able to conduct your business through English or Irish. You're given that choice. All of our street names, as you've probably seen going around.
Yes, I can't pronounce them.
Yeah, but don't worry, most Irish people won't be able to pronounce them either. But yes, you know, that most streets will have the street name in English and Irish. They're both languages are the language of the state. Our president is, our prime minister has given an old Gaelic name, which is called Taoiseach, which phonetically is like tea and shock. And that's his name. His deputy is called the Taoiseach, which would have been a time when these were the names of leaders of clans. not the neighbours, but the position, the name of the position of a leader of a clan. So yes, you know, the Gaelic, the Irish language, the Gaelic language has played a big part, you know, in recent history in particular.
You know? There's been a real revival of it, hasn't there?
There is, yeah. You know, you'll find that a lot of the children now are being sent to schools that have a leaning towards Gaelic and the Irish language. A piece of trivia for your listeners. John Kennedy stayed in this very hotel.
Well, it doesn't surprise me, but I guess I hadn't realized that until you said it.
John Kennedy stayed here twice. A senator, when he was a senator of Massachusetts, with Mrs. Kennedy. And then on the 27th of July 1963, which, as your listeners will know, was the year that following that November he was assassinated
right.
in Dallas. John Kennedy stayed here. And if you ever have a chance of looking back at the funeral of President Kennedy at Arlington Cemetery, you will notice that there's an honour guard which is slightly different to any of the military uniforms, because it's in black and white, but you'll notice. But listen, I ask your listeners if they ever put it on YouTube and listen, they're not going to be able to understand what the commands are, because the guard of honour, who provided the guard of honour at the cemetery in Arlington, was of the Irish cadet school of the Irish Military College, because John Kennedy had said on a visit when he was here how impressed he was by their drill expertise, that he would like them to form part of the honour guard. And Mrs. Kennedy asked, when President Kennedy was assassinated, for the honour, not knowing that it's going to be in the same year, but Mrs. Kennedy asked for the Irish soldiers' cadet school, which is your West Point, to come and to provide the honour guard. And if you listen very clearly, the commands are given in the Irish language.
I had no idea.
And they recently, last year, did a documentary on that, because most of those officers have now all retired, and some of them have deceased and some are still alive. But yes, you listen to it very, very carefully. So the Irish language, and there's pockets of Ireland in the country, and I know you've travelled around, but there's places in Ireland where the signage will only be in Irish, because Irish language is the first language of that particular area. And they're called Gaeltacht, which is kind of an Irish word for generalisation of Irishness or Irish-only type of stuff. You'd have people who live out in the wildest wildest places in the Western Seaboard who won't speak English.
That was going to be my next question. This is just a tourist question, but as someone who doesn't speak any Gaelic, any Irish, I guess there are parts of this country where I might have a little difficulty being understood then.
Yeah, you certainly would, you know, and it's not because they're disrespectful, or it's not because there's a sense of anarchy or anything else, but they have known nothing else.
Right, that's their language.
Be parts of the United States where you'd have people who would probably speak Creole, or they would probably speak Mexican.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a number of places where Spanish is essentially the first
absolutely.
Language these days.
Well,
yeah,
here would be that it's safe that you have people who don't speak Irish.
Of course, if you go to my home state or where my family's from in Tennessee, some of my family speaks with such strong accents, I think you might have difficulty.
That's it, accents. Like, there's parts of this country here that I'd have difficulty straining the ear and making out what people are saying. And that's actually particular in the Irish language, because you have different dialects from different areas. So you'd have to maybe strain your ear, because you learned your Irish. Very interesting. You live on the Eastern Seaboard and your teacher could be from the South.
Right.
And you learn his dialect. And then when you go to college, summer camp, to learn the language better, you're learning it in a Western part, which has a completely different dialect. And you would have found that you're a bit confused. But yeah, everything here. And even the draft of the Constitution of 1922, one of them was in Irish.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dennis O'Brien, the head concierge and unofficial historian of the historic Shelburne Hotel in Dublin, Ireland, where the Irish Constitution was drafted. After the break, we have a special treat for you, a little field trip there in Dublin to a place that, let's just say it has something to do with world records. Stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dennis O'Brien of the historic Shelburne Hotel in Dublin, where the Irish Constitution was drafted many years ago. That's a fascinating discussion, but it's rather serious. So I think it's time for a visit to a pub there in Dublin, or actually a place that's very important to pubs, a place that maybe you've heard of, especially if you, like me, as a kid, read something called the Guinness Book of World Records. Yes, I'm talking about the old historic Guinness Brewery right there in downtown Dublin. I was walking down the street with my son Ben, who'd been in Ireland most of the summer, and we were supposedly heading toward an Irish historical museum when he looked up and he said, "You know, Dad, I think that's the Guinness Brewery over there." And just somehow, magically, we found ourselves at the entrance, and then we found ourselves inside, and one of the first people we encountered was a lovely redheaded young woman named Jill.
My name is Jill. I'm an assistant here at the Storehouse. I'm hopefully going to be able to give you a little bit of an idea of what it is we do here.
And between your accent, your lovely blue eyes, and your beautiful red hair, I'm guessing you are an Irish woman.
Oh, you're very kind. I am Dublin born and bred.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Happy to say. Yeah, absolutely.
What a great town this is. How does one get such a fantastic job?
A sunny disposition is probably the best answer to that question. It runs in the family as well. I think my great-grandfather was a cooper at Guinness, so it's kind of...
Are you serious?
Yeah.
And a cooper is a barrel maker, right?
Cooper's a barrel maker. It was one of the most highly skilled positions in the brewery at the time as well.
So I may have tasted some Guinness that came out of one of your grandfather's barrels.
Well, I would hope not at this stage. You'd want to be fresher than that.
Well, I suppose that's true.
Yeah.
All right, well, Jill, now tell me... about where we are. What are we doing?
Well, we're standing here in St. James's Gate. This is where Guinness has been brewed since 1759, when Arthur opened his very first brewery. He signed a lease for 9,000 years for this building. A pretty substantial commitment, but something we're very proud of. Our Arthur right. Guinness was a man with great vision.
Right.
So from then up until this very day, we've been brewing here at St. James's Gate, and the Storehouse is a building that is designed specifically to give you an idea of the story of Guinness and to tell you the story of Arthur and how this beautiful place and this institution of our country came to be.
What are we going to see today? Because I'm just starting my tour here. You're the first lovely red-headed Irish woman that I've seen since I've been here. So I really am completely ignorant. What am I going to see here today?
Well, there are seven floors, and on the seven floors you're designed to come across the story of Guinness. So you're going to go through the ingredients, the roasting, the brewing, and then of course by the time you get to our gravity bar you will be onto the tasting.
Tremendous.
Yeah, the building is also designed quite similarly to a pint of Guinness. You come in through the lower ground floor where it's very dark and you move slowly up towards our beautiful gravity bar, which signifies the head of the pint. It's 44 metres up above the air, or above the ground level, I should say, and it's completely glass, so it's got a view of the city and it's entirely natural light.
What you're telling me then is for today, I am a beer bubble.
For a moment, rising.
And I am rising
through
the
beer. You are a bubble
beer.
Of nitrogen rising towards the head of
this
pint of Guinness.
That's not a bad fate. It's not a bad fate at all. In fact, I rather like that metaphor.
Yeah, I think it's a good one.
Tremendous. Anything in particular I should look out for today?
I think you should definitely check out the Academy Bar. That's where we teach you how to pour a pint of Guinness for yourself, so you can become an expert Guinness crafter.
And I thought I was an expert already, but okay, now I'm going to hone my skills.
There's always more to learn.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. Thanks.
All right.
I hope you enjoy your day.
Well, I don't know about you, but now I feel refreshed, and I'm ready to head back and finish my discussion with Dennis O'Brien of the Shelburne Hotel, all about the drafting of the Irish Constitution.
Yeah, let's get back to that, because, of course, that you have this wonderful small museum downstairs, right across from your desk, actually, and I did take a look at it yesterday. And they actually have drafts of the Constitution that were right there, and that's where they wrote it, right here in what you now call the Constitution Room. Right?
Absolutely. The first person to receive a copy of the draft, after it was drafted and signed by the participants, was the general manager of the hotel, Mr. George Oldham.
Seriously?
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Great.
You know, it's real Irish kind of thing, you know.
Thanks for letting us use your hotel here. Have
yeah,
a copy.
Absolutely. Thought you might want a bit of light reading when you go to bed tonight. And then there's a room full of, around the corner, there's a 100 plus politicians who need to know where they're going. But they can wait. The general manager has been so good to us, we give him a copy. I suppose a tremendous vote of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and thankfully to this day we have it. There are very few hotels in the world. And, you know, I travel extensively. And I love my history. did I know this much about this old lady? No. But have I learned a lot? Yeah, I learn every day.
Right. Now, was that draft eventually then the progenitor of what was ultimately adopted?
That was part of it, of what was ultimately adopted in 22.
Now, so there was a constitution, it was adopted in 1922.
Absolutely. It
was, so is that when the Irish Republic began?
No, much later. We would have had to go through various things. We weren't completely independent from the British. There was a certain amount of what we could and could not do. But the draft...
And that was all in the treaty that had been so controversial. Yeah. So did you have something similar to Dominion status that Canada had for all those years?
Yes, we would have been kind of like... when you say we're not the Irish delegation. So there wasn't kind of an acceptance of a government. There was kind of a... I suppose a committee. Mm-hmm. Dominion is probably the better word for using it. But that one in 22 was a precursor to the one of 1937. So the Constitution today, and remember, in the Constitution, they don't have one in England because they have a monarchy. Mm-hmm. But here, the Constitution tells our government how they can govern us. So tomorrow, if, for instance, the President of the European Commission says the language in the European Union from the 1st of September will be Greek, and our Prime Minister can say, we agree to that, thank you very much. What he's got to do and come to us and say, everybody who's entitled to vote, do you agree that the new language of the European Union will be Greek? And we have it in Irish and in English. Neil means no, and ta means yes. And you tick the box. So every constitution, every referendum on the constitution to this very day, asks you a question, and all you do is vote yes or no, or neil and ta, which is the Irish version. And we have one most years. The next one will be on same-sex marriage. We've had one recently.
Well, you have a constitutional referendum on same-sex marriage coming up.
Marriage.
When is that going to be voted on?
It's on October this year.
Really? It's going to be Neil and Ta.
Neil and Ta, which is yes and no.
That's great.
Last year we did it on the rights of the child. Previously we did it on the salaries of the judiciary and the right of the parliament to hold people before committees, to investigate people. Committees could investigate people. We said yes, the judges should have their pay capped, and we said no, that the parliament does not have the right to intervene or interfere with individual private lives. We're given that right. We're asked, and we say yes or we say no.
It sounds like you have quite a few constitutional referenda here then.
Yeah, we've had a number of referenda over the years. For years we wouldn't have had any. But mm-hmm. then, you know, people are more educated now. Mm-hmm. They're more savvy to what's going on in the world. I can tell you, my first vote when I was 18, if the government said that it's right to do it, or yes, we want you to do it, 80% would have gone with them. Now, it could be 49-51. It could be, you know, 50.99 and 49.1. You know, you're only a hair's breadth away. So that, depending on the referendum, the vote, but like in recent years they've been very close. Like we didn't allow divorce for a number of years, and then we had enough of a referendum, and then thankfully people said, you know, people who are in marriages, you know, shouldn't be left. So yeah, it's all changed.
And so divorce is now legal.
It's now legal. Right. And to think that all happened in this very hotel in 1922 makes this place for me historically very special, but also makes for me a very proud place to work, because I know that the actions of a group of men, and they were all men as we said, still reverberates around our state in 2014.
But you mentioned they're all men, and that's certainly true of our constitutional history, but you have or have had female prime ministers, right?
We've had female presidents.
Presidents, excuse my ignorance.
Yeah, our president is the head of state. Mm-hmm. And the Taoiseach is the Prime Minister. We haven't had the Deputy Prime Minister. We've had a couple of female Deputy Prime Ministers, which at the moment we have a Taoiseach, who's mm-hmm. a member of the Labour Party, and a lady. And we've had two presidents who were ladies. The present president is President Michael D. Higgins. Mm-hmm. But his immediate two predecessors were President Mary McAleese and President Mary Robinson.
Now, when you say the president is the head of state here, is that more of a ceremonial job then, or does it actually have a lot of power?
In recent years, that has changed. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, it would have been ceremonial and signing when bills have been passed by both houses of the parliament, upper and lower house, the president would sign them into law, but has within his or her power the right not to sign it and to seek guidance on it, which they have done before. So, and also, I think in recent years they have been less ceremonial and more, what would you call them, advocates. Mm-hmm. You know, it allows them to speak out and say, you know, it's not right to do that.
Teddy Roosevelt called it the bully pulpit. It's one of the powers you have if you're head of state.
Yeah.
Simply to go out and try to persuade people. That is just remarkable. You know, I'm really struck by the similarity in some respects with our own experience in the United States, because we did have our revolution in 1776, and then it took us about 11 years before we came together and formed our Constitution, and which is more or less endured in its original form to this day. But there's a distinction between a revolution and a constitutional process, and they don't necessarily follow one after the other.
No.
But I guess that's really interesting. So you guys got your act together in about 6 years.
Yeah, well, you know, I think no matter which way you take it, it's a hard road.
Sure.
You know, anything, as you know, anything that's worth doing will take time. I think history has shown that decisions that are made on a knee-jerk reaction really cost more harm than good. You know, in modern day things, everything is thought through before it's developed. You know, you've got to think these men and women, you know, were ahead of their times. Like Michael Collins was always said, he died when he was 32 years of age.
Wow.
Who assassinated him? We don't know. It's a bit like President Kennedy and him. They say it was one person, and logistically another thing you wouldn't be able to do. Anyway, Collins was assassinated on the 22nd of August, 1922. Just finished
right, all, right after he finished?
Right the after he finished all his work on the Irish Constitution while visiting, he was Chief of Staff of the Army, while visiting his native county Cork in a place that was known in Gaelic as Béal na Bláth, which means the mouth of the flower. And I suppose you would never consider a flower to do anything but cause beauty and colour. But in Béal na Bláth, the mouth of the flower, Michael Collins was assassinated. Hmm. De Valera, who was the leader of the anti-treaty, always said that history will not look kindly on him, meaning that it'll always maintain that De Valera had a part to play. We never know. Maybe someday we will, but at the moment, his main adversary. Michael Collins had one of the biggest funerals the state has ever seen. Hundreds of thousands of people.
Was it held here?
In Dublin. Mm-hmm. And Michael Collins is buried with, you know, your kind of place where all of your heroes is Arrington in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And we have ours at Glasnevin in Dublin, where O'Connell, O'Donovan Rossa, Patrick Pearse, Michael Collins, and De Valera are all buried. So yeah, it was not long after he finished the work here that Michael Collins was assassinated. But you know, there's very few places in the world, and particularly commercial properties like a hotel, where you will go into the room or go into the building and have a room of such historical significance.
Right, and people can actually stay in it. We would have gone up there and had this interview there, except someone's actually staying in that room.
It's a meeting room, so somebody's having a meeting there.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah, it's like this room. It's twice or three times the size. There's a table, the original table and chairs are there. You can have a meeting. You can sit around and have your board meeting. You can finish then and come back a couple of hours later and sit and have dinner at the same table. Or as I do on the third Sunday of every month, invite people in to give them a little insight into what this old lady's about and sit and have a cup of tea and coffee and a cookie on the same table in which the Constitution was drafted in 1922.
Well, Dennis O'Brien, I'm very sorry we weren't able to sit in there and have this conversation, but we're pretty darn close here.
We are.
And you set this up very nicely, and you've gotten some nice bottled water for us, and this has just been delightful for me. Is there anything you'd care to add before we finish?
No, I, any of your listeners who are ever traveling to Ireland, if you're staying here, well and good. If you're not, you're more than welcome at any time to come in, and if the room is not in use. The great thing about us here is we're carrying the baton for the next generation and generations to come. What we have here, we're very proud of. It's not lost on us the historical significance, but we make it available for anybody who likes to see it. So if you come by and you want to see, and if the room is not in use, we'd be delighted to show you. As you said, we also have a lovely museum, which we have collected in this very week, the 28th of July, 1914, the start of the First World War. We have on display in the museum the registration book for that day.
Oh dear,
New York, Philadelphia. And then on the other side, balance out, we have the 24th of April, 1916, which is the day that the insurrection started, and then you'll see the people. And then we have little memorabilia. We have a picture of Princess Grace of Monaco, who was probably our foremost guest. We have pictures of staff members over the years. We have letters. You can see the title of the people who stayed here.
And you've got registration books going back
registration
centuries.
Books from about 1914, 1912. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had people come in here and say, can I have a look at the book? And we allow people access to it, and they say, oh my God, that's my grandfather's signature.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I had a man come back a couple of months ago, and he said, I don't know when I stayed here, what day, but I can tell you that I was 4 years of age, and there was a boxing match on between this Irishman and this Englishman. Of course, thank God for Wikipedia and Google. And we found out when that date was, and 74 years after he had seen it, he found his father's signature in the registry book.
How nice.
And yeah. How emotional that man was, and that's, you know, the little things that it's about. And I'm delighted that I had the opportunity to welcome you into, as we call it, the Grand Dame of the Green, and to share some of what this old lady's about with you.
Well, thank you so very much for your time. Definitely. We really appreciate it. It's been a delight, and I've had the privilege of staying here for a couple of days as a guest, and I can tell you the guest experience is extraordinary as well, so I will recommend it to everyone.
Thank you very much indeed, Stuart. Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much both to Jill at the Guinness Brewery and, of course, to Dennis O'Brien, the head concierge at the historic and wonderful and fabulous Shelburne Hotel in Dublin, Ireland. I so recommend that you go there. I recommend that you go to Ireland because it's fantastic, and I recommend that you stay at the Shelburne. That's the experience. And I also recommend you go and speak with Dennis. Hi, Dennis. You were fantastic. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, but other countries, they also have their constitutional experiments.